Hello, Florida Bar members and Florida registered paralegals. This is a quick reminder from the Standing Committee on Mental Health and Wellness of Florida Lawyers that you are approved to use the Florida Lawyers Helpline, a completely free and confidential around-the-clock helpline designed to support you in managing the challenges of both your personal and professional life. By dialing 833-FL1-WELL or 833-351-9355, you can connect with mental health professionals who are ready to assist you. Take advantage of up to 5 complimentary in-person or telehealth counseling sessions annually, and remember, there's no limit to the number of calls you can make. Reach out today.
You're listening to the Florida Bar Podcast, brought to you by the Florida Bar's Practice Resource Center, Legal Fuel. Produced by the broadcast professionals of the Florida Bar.
Welcome to the Florida Bar's Legal Fuel podcast, brought to you by the Practice Resource Center of the Florida Bar. We're so glad you're joining us. This is Christine Bilberry. I'm the director of the Practice Resource Center and one of the hosts of the show, which is being recorded from our studio in Tallahassee, Florida.
And I'm Jamie Moore. I'm a practice management advisor at the Florida Bar and co-host of today's podcast. Our goal at the Practice Resource Center is to assist Florida attorneys with running the business side of their law practices. We focus on a different topic each month and carry the theme through our website with related tips, videos, and articles.
So in the rapidly evolving world of technology, few innovations have sparked as much curiosity and controversy as generative AI. Imagine a tool that can pass the bar exam, draft your legal briefs, and redefine the very process of legal writing. But as we look to the future of artificial intelligence in law, we're faced with profound questions. Can a machine truly understand the law? What happens to concepts like authorship, ethics, and attorney-client privilege in a world where AI is a co-author? Joining us today to explore these questions is Professor Kirsten Davis, professor of law at Stetson University College of Law and an expert in generative artificial intelligence in legal writing.
Kirsten Davis is a professor and provost faculty fellow for generative artificial intelligence and higher education at Stetson University College of Law. She earned her JD from Ohio State and a PhD in human communication from Arizona State University. Prior to joining the faculty at Stetson Law, she was a federal judicial clerk, an attorney at Jones Day, and a faculty member at the Arizona State University College of Law. Dr. Davis has served on the board of the Association of Legal Writing Directors and the Legal Writing Institute. She is a past chair of the Florida Bar Standing Committee on Professionalism, serving as the program co-chair for the Association of American Law School Section on Technology, Law, and Legal Education. As a member of Legal Writing Institute's AI Committee, and as a member of the Florida Bar Standing Committee on Technology. Dr. Davis's work focuses on the intersection of legal communication and legal ethics. Most recently, she has been studying the impact of generative artificial intelligence on legal communication, legal ethics, and higher education. She is currently leading a group of over 400 law professors who are exploring the impacts of generative AI on legal writing education and practice. Her course, Legal Writing with Generative AI, was one of the first of its kind to be offered to law students. Welcome to the show, Dr. Davis.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's really great to be here.
We're thrilled to have you. So obviously this is a hot topic, but your approach is a little different than we've covered before. And I like that you're out there teaching the next generation of attorneys so that they're going to be fully versed in this. But before we dive in, can you describe what generative AI is and what lawyers should generally know about it?
Sure. So I think when we talk about generative AI, the first thing you want to know is how it works, right? So you want to understand it is, for our purposes in the law, largely predictive technology, right? Predicting the next, it's very sophisticated, but predicting the next word and how that differs perhaps from the way lawyers reason through a problem so that you understand what features will be useful to you as a legal communicator and what features you have to bring to that relationship. It's also a really good idea to understand the ethical constraints that face you. And those are both constraints that the bar imposes through legal ethics. And then there are also sort of questions about communication ethics, like the question of authenticity. And knowing what generative AI, as I mentioned, how it works, but also what it does well and what it doesn't do as well can really help you understand how to use it. And then thinking about the skills that you might need to use a generative AI tool really well, including what I think is a relatively new skill that we implicitly do in our brain a lot, but haven't really thought about how we articulate it. And that is the skill of prompting, right? Giving the machine natural language instructions on what you would like it to produce. So those are the things, you know, off the top of my head that when I'm talking to lawyers and giving presentations are the kind of things that I'm covering for them, which is slightly different than what we might offer for someone in law school, where our concerns are just a little bit different as students are learning about how to be lawyers while at the same time having access to this tool.
That makes sense.
It does. So, Dr. Davis, what do you believe are the main strengths and limitations of generative AI for legal writing?
So for legal writing, so thinking about communication, some of the strengths include, I think, the idea of brainstorming or generating ideas. So lawyers know that all ideas have to fit within the legal framework that confronts you, right? Whatever jurisdiction you're in, whatever arguments you make, or whatever you're going to be doing has to fit pretty neatly within that framework. But generative AI tools can help lawyers think through a problem. People who study design thinking or creativity talk about this process as divergent thinking, meaning that we want to generate as many ideas as we possibly can before we choose the ones or the one that we're going to pursue. And so I think generative AI, because it has been trained on such a large corpus of language, can be pretty good at identifying various patterns in language, mashing up different kinds of patterns to help us generate lots of ideas. So that would be one strength. Another strength is the wheelhouse of language. So it is good at thinking through, or helping us think through, I should say, grammar, spelling, punctuation, clarity, consistency, brevity. It's good at understanding tone and giving us options for different kinds of tone in our writing, for different kinds of genres of writing, how to structure something. It's good at structuring and restructuring text. So if I want to offer an idea in simpler language, if I want to present something as a table or as a list, generative AI can help me do that pretty quickly. It can be good at helping us interact to practice things. It can be good at role playing, something that might be challenging for us to get ready to do. And then I think the big weaknesses are threefold. There are more than three weaknesses, but the first is what is commonly called hallucination, or we can call that inaccuracy, right? The machine, a generative AI tool, is actually meant to, right, to be somewhat creative, and that creativity results in incorrect information. So a generative AI tool is not necessarily grounded in a truth. And so instead it's predicting patterns in language, and those language patterns can be absolutely correct as a matter of a correct sentence, right? And as a communication, but it isn't necessarily accurate with respect to the content. And where we've seen that most recently and most frequently is in the area of false citations, right? That the generative AI tool generates a citation to a case that isn't true, that isn't accurate, does not exist, and the lawyer relies on that without doing what a lawyer should do, which is verify and check the citations, and it turns out to be wrong. So that's just one example. There are lots of different kinds of examples of that. The second right now, I think, is confidentiality. The Florida Bar, for example, has been very clear about its intention to say to lawyers that you have a duty in using a generative AI tool to, while you're doing that, to keep that information that you have always had to keep confidential. And perhaps one of the things that you know, is different here is that we aren't normally giving the machine as much data or information as we do when we're prompting a generative AI tool. So we have to think about where that information is stored, whether it is used in the future to train models, how that information might be accessed. Confidentiality is a big concern in choosing what tools the lawyer will use in terms of assistance with legal communication. So, and then the third, I would say, is bias and harmful communication, right? So we know the generative AI tools, many of them that we have now, are trained on a lot of information scraped from the web and other sources. And it wasn't necessarily that that information was kept, was sorted through for what might be bias or harmful information. And so when a lawyer is using a generative AI tool, the lawyer needs to think about what kinds of information is being produced, whether that information has a particular perspective, whether that perspective is harmful. Lawyers have an ethical duty to be sensitive to that kind of bias. And so that is a danger as well. So we have to be careful not to over-rely on what a generative AI tool produces and instead think carefully about the results that we're getting so that we're doing what we always do as lawyers, really, really being careful in our analysis and communication. So that was a lot. I think that's about right with respect to strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah, absolutely. Back about a year or two ago when AI was becoming more mainstream, there was a moment in time where a prompt engineer was going to be the hot new job for people. And then I think very quickly, the AI companies realized that it needed to be way more user-friendly. And so now, you know, you can just use natural language. But if you are using it for legal research or writing, are there some practical ways to improve the prompts that you are putting into the product you're using?
Yes, I think that you're right about this, at least with respect to lawyers using generative AI in everyday practice. And that is, I don't think you need to think about this as engineering as much as engaging in a dialogue. So there are really two things I can think of. The first is really thinking about structuring your prompts in a useful way for the situation that you're in. And the second is to think about iteration. The idea that your first prompt isn't necessarily going to get you what you want from the tool, but that a dialogue or iterating with the machine will be more helpful. So when I think of communicating with a machine, right, and that's what we're engaged in here, human-machine communication, which is an entire field of study in and of itself, I think of that situation because of my training in rhetoric as a rhetorical situation. So every time a person enters a situation where you might be able to influence the audience, rhetoric scholars call that the rhetorical situation, and it has parts, right? And those parts are things that you would normally think about. What is the need that you have? What are you trying to change? Who is the audience? What constraints are you facing as the speaker or the writer? And then who are you in this context? And what are you trying to write? What kind of document or what kind of address are you giving? So if you think of what you're doing for the machine as creating the rhetorical situation that you have come to, what is the situation where you need to attempt to influence either action or thought? Then you begin to understand better that you are crafting in writing through that prompt, the rhetorical situation for the tool, which has no other ability to get to that situation except through what you write. So I think of five questions that really are built around that rhetorical situation that you can use to structure a prompt. So who is speaking? Who is the writer here? What characteristics do you have as a speaker? And that helps tailor that result, that output, to how you would like it to sound. Who is the audience? Who is listening? What do they need? How are they likely to respond? So explaining to generative AI your audience characteristics can help it better identify language patterns that will be useful to you. The same way with the needs, or what scholars call the exigence, but you can think of it as needs. Why are you writing this? What are your goals? And then what constraints do you face? What constraints on the document? What facts might you have, or laws, or jurisdiction, or rules? And again, generative AI is not going to be necessarily truth grounded. in finding facts or laws or rules, but it can help identify patterns. And then it is your job as the lawyer to verify all of the accuracy of the content. Helping it with those constraints can help it give you more useful output. And then the written product, what are you shooting for here? What kind of quality should the document have? What kind of tone? What is the genre? How would you like it organized? So those prompts are not the same as a Google search. When we think of a Google search, that's much shorter frequently that we write. This is really about constructing the context for the machine. And so I think of it as those five parts: writer, audience, exigence or needs, constraints, and what is the written product. And then as you get results, right, you're adapting to that by noticing that your rhetorical situation, your interaction with the machine is changing. And each time you re-prompt, right, you're helping the machine adjust those patterns to your needs. But I can't emphasize enough that, you know, in this hybrid writing, we'll call it, it's really important for the lawyer to stay engaged. I don't think of this as automated writing. I think of this as assisted writing or a collaboration where you as the lawyer are in charge and the AI is your assistant, which means you are taking mental responsibility for whatever's generated.
And it does it really well. For a presentation, you could say, explain AI to a group of judges. And so then it spits out a whole presentation explaining it. And then you could immediately, in your next prompt, say, now do it for an audience of high school students. And it's amazing how it tweaks the language, tailors it so neatly to what you've given it. And I hope people are playing with it. I think a lot of attorneys were kind of afraid to jump in. But we are, I want to note here that the Board of Governors Special Committee on AI Tools and Resources is about to release a Getting Started Guide for AI. And it's going to give you some prompts to play with and give you some links on, you know, free products that you could go just experiment with before you decide to commit to one of the legal specific AI products that are out there. But can you give us an example, just for the sake of, you know, like if you were teaching this, what's a prompt you would throw out? And then tell us just a couple ways you would tweak it when you're explaining this to your students.
I think one I have done with students in the past is there is a very simple writing problem for the first year. And again, I don't want to lead our listeners to believe that generative AI is being fully integrated into the first year writing curriculum, because as professors in law schools, we're not sure yet about the best place to introduce these tools. And so we're, like you, we're learning and we're experimenting. But one of the things that I have been playing around with is thinking about this very classic first year writing problem, very simple, more of an exercise, I'd say, than a writing problem. And that is the vehicle in the park problem. So you imagine that your client has been charged with unlawfully having a vehicle in the park. And it turns out that that's a bicycle the client has had. But the statute that makes this illegal doesn't define what a vehicle is. And so one of the things that I, you know, start with is what kinds of arguments might I make, right? Assuming that they're grounded in the law, and of course, I'm going to do that as well. What kinds of things might I argue? And I might start with asking the generative AI to give me a handful of arguments, give me five different kinds of arguments that might be grounded in the law of my jurisdiction, right? So what I'm engaging in is some divergent thinking here. What are some different possibilities of arguments I might make? And it might give me a variety of options, like a public policy option or a functional option or something based on what it thinks might be the legislative intent. And so I might start by getting a wide variety of those options. And then this is where iteration begins, right? So I might ask it, you know, if it says, well, bicycles are functionally different from the kinds of vehicles the statute might really be contemplating. I might drill down deeper into that. I might ask generative AI, well, what kinds of characteristics might be different, or what might be analogous, or what might be contradictory? And really, what I'm engaging in a way, is some play here, play to help me generate ideas. And so after I do that process, then I would take those ideas to a reliable research database, right, and begin to go to the law to find the law on point and ask which of these ideas might be supported in the law. It might also be that I find other ideas supported in the law that generative AI didn't come up with. So this becomes part and parcel of my ways of using tools to imagine and invent, to supplement my research, and then to begin to think about, okay, well, once I come up with some ideas, then perhaps this now can help me construct those best ideas into something useful for making an argument, whether that's an outline or a document. Just depends on what you need.
Okay. The old model was a lot of times that a partner would have a new case, and so they would have associate attorneys go research it for them and create a brief, you know, to start all the different issues at hand. And so the function I really love about AI is how you can upload a lot of documents and it will create a legal brief for you. Do you think that AI is doing this effectively? And if an attorney is uploading, you know, different documents, can you tell us practically what they should be doing regarding confidentiality and the attorney-client privilege?
Yeah, so you've asked a lot of different questions there. So the first thing, again, I just want to reiterate, and I can't say this enough, is that the lawyer is responsible for the communication, right? Ethically, this is absolutely true. And one of the risks of generative AI that I did not mention before is this idea of over-reliance or outsourcing one's judgment to the tool. And again, generative AI is not thinking like you and I as lawyers think. You know, one of the harder things it has trouble with is recognizing hierarchy of authority, for example. And so when you think about the difference between prediction and analysis of ideas, you know, that can help you think through that a little bit. So again, this is a language assistant, right, that is really, really good at language. What you're talking about is the concept of grounding your prompts in a set of documents. Some of the traditional research databases are grounding their tools in that kind of ground, right, to assist with improving hallucinations. Although, you know, some of the research we have suggests that this type of grounding does not cure hallucination, but it can improve it. And so lawyers can do the same thing. They can upload some documents and ask questions of those documents or ask the machine to use those documents as the ground for generating content. One thing I would say is that I do not think in any context that this process of uploading documents replaces your duty to read the documents and know what they say. And so, you know, I think the thing that is best is to think of, you know, your intelligence first, right? Lawyer intelligence first, and then you can use artificial intelligence to assist you. So you've got to know what you're using, what it says, and then, you know, the tool can be helpful to you in deriving things that you can then check and ensure are correct. And so that you can do that. Now, you mentioned about confidentiality. Again, I cannot emphasize this enough as well. So I'm sure you know, right, and in the Florida ethics, right, the rules of professional conduct, we all have a duty to be technologically aware, to understand the benefits and risks of the technology we use, and to be competent in that area. And so, you know, lawyers need to be thinking about the same kinds of questions that they would ask of other technologies in terms of data privacy and security, of preventing unauthorized access to client information. And really, you know, what I'll say is that, you know, I won't, because I'm not a Florida licensed lawyer, and so, and this is not legal advice, but you know, Florida's ethics opinion 24-1 is really quite good at, you know, describing the kinds of things that lawyers should be thinking through when they are dealing with generative AI. And again, those are the same kinds of questions we have when we're thinking about cloud storage of content, when we're thinking about the security of email, when we're thinking about using third-party vendors. I mean, you have to keep those things in mind, because that, again, when you're uploading information into a third-party vendor, you have to ask about how that information is treated.
Yeah. And if you look at the terms of service, I've seen several where it says, we don't use your prompts to train our large language model, or you can delete all of your prompts and they won't be saved in our system. So you do need to read in, you know.
Yeah. And I think too, you know, one concern you want to think about is how and when that information is stored. Right. So when you upload a document, is it stored with the servers of the third party provider? What does that mean? Even if there is a commitment not to train new models, it may be that it's stored at least for some period of time. So then you're asking yourself questions simply about unauthorized disclosure, right? And when you think about storing your files in the cloud storage, you're asking, you know, what's the risk of this being hacked, right? Or someone getting unauthorized access. And that, you know, that's a similar question you want to ask with respect to generative AI tools as well. So it's not just questions about intentionally revealing this information. It's the question of unintentional revelation in a way as well. And then, you know, the Florida Bar does talk about in 24.1 whether or not you need to think about client consent, right? And the level of risk that the tool you're using presents to their information. They recommend early on in that opinion that, you know, that lawyers get informed consent for using generative AI when they're going to be using confidential client information in it.
Yeah. And that's one of the big discussions that I've heard go back and forth between saying, well, you know, I don't have to get client permission to have a team of associates do it. Why do I have to get my AI, you know, permission to use AI? So I've seen both sides of that. So I think that's
right. And I think we'll see more sorting out of this question as we go. Remember, we are still really, really early in this. You know, there is a wonderful writer of a book I would recommend, Ethan Mollick, who is a University of Pennsylvania Wharton School professor who studies in this area. He's written a book called Co-Intelligence, and he reminds us that, you know, this is right now at this moment is the worst AI you will ever use. And so it just reminds me that all of these features of AI will likely get better, and the confidentiality, the data privacy tools built around these will get stronger as well. But it's really important, I think, that lawyers are asking these questions before they're putting information into generative AI tools.
Thanks. That's all very clear. I also want to mention, because I already mentioned the upcoming Getting Started guide that's coming from the AI committee.
Yeah.
But they are going to include a sample retainer that includes the language for people that want to, because as of this moment, it's not a requirement, but it, you know, by the time this podcast comes out, maybe, you know, there's going to be an opinion. We don't know, but there will be a sample retainer agreement if you feel that you want to disclose the use of AI to your clients. So look for that in that guide.
And there could be real benefits to clients. You know, certainly, you know, we want to think about a couple things. Can we improve the efficiency of our work such that that is a benefit to clients, right? That there's a cost savings involved to them. We can think about cost savings from our perspective, right? What does it allow us to do with our lives and with respect to the amount of work and a kind of a, I hate to use the phrase work-life balance, right? But those questions come up in this context of what this might mean to some wellness aspects. And then for me, what I am really interested in is, does it improve the quality of our work? And, you know, in my experience, right, there are definitely quality improvements that can happen with thinking about using generative AI as an assistant. So I think of, you know, both not just efficiency, but overall quality for lawyers and clients.
I agree. So I want to talk now about the paper that was published in the Stetson Law Review Forum, because you raised some really interesting questions, which include what it means to write as a legal writer when generative AI is involved. So how does AI change the writing process, and how might it decenter human authors?
Yeah, so this, I think, is one of our biggest challenges when we think about lawyering on the whole, is this idea of what it means to write as a lawyer. So up until this moment, we have always had some human at some point be the generator of the content. Now, that doesn't mean that we haven't had others write for us in many situations. So, for example, firms will have banks of documents that they, you know, go back to as models for what they might write in the future. Judges have clerks who draft drafts of opinions. Partners have junior associates draft content, right? I mean, so we've had, and we use forms frequently as a basis for doing our work. But in general, right, all of those different resources were human generated from the very beginning. And so one of the questions that I think is really important is this notion of how am I authentic as a writer, right? When my content is generated from scratch by a machine. And so my role with the writing process is going to require me to stay engaged in a different way because I could easily, because this is, you know, this information is generated by a machine, it could easily allow me to check out, right, and not engage with the content in the same way. So it's going to make us think more clearly or more deeply about what it means to have this kind of automated, that's not the best word, this predictive, right, this computational predictive writing partner that can accelerate some of the features, make those features better, and for us to stay engaged. So writing is going to be more, I think, of a hybrid process with the AI and the human working together in that regard. I think that's just one of the big things that we have to think about is how do I remain centered, right, in that writing process in control rather than becoming peripheral while really finding all of the great features that generative AI has to enhance my work.
That makes sense to me. You quote Gerald Postema's book, Law's Rule, where he states, computers don't understand the languages they translate, and they don't understand or appreciate the propositions, facts, norms, arguments found in the legal text fed to them. So how can attorneys ensure that AI aligns with the values and principles of the legal system?
So you must, as the lawyer, stay engaged. So again, I just really encourage lawyers to resist this idea of automated writing or sort of optimized writing. We're not looking for, in my opinion, sort of a factory-like process of replicating content. Now, certainly, right, we reuse forms, we reuse templates frequently as lawyers, and there is nothing wrong with that. But we know, right, we have this mental responsibility for that content, and we understand what it says, and we know why a template or a form is being reused. You know, again, if we understand that generative AI is a language prediction tool. A citation is a great example of this. A generative AI can reproduce a citation, right? It can mimic the form of a citation, but it won't necessarily, and again, I'm talking about sort of a publicly available non-legal model, I'm not talking about sort of the legal research defined models, but public-facing model can come up with a form of a citation, but it doesn't understand what that citation means with respect to, you know, whether that's the right authority you need, whether it's even actually, you know, has the right case name or is from the right court, it will construct a form that looks like the form that you want. And sometimes that will be a real case. And sometimes that won't. And of course, our job then is to verify whether those things are real or not. And so when we're talking about lawyers, you know, with a special duty as a citizen who is meant to protect justice, right, that is in the both the model rules and the Florida rules of professional conduct in the preamble, that we have a duty to engage in that content in a way that goes beyond what generative AI is doing as a prediction machine. So ultimately, you know, it really means being engaged with the content as you always would have been. I think we are in a position where our skills as lawyers need to be sharper, perhaps, than they've been in the past, because we're going to be expected to work with a lot of content that we did not generate in the beginning. So critically reading content, really important. You know, being careful about and staying engaged in what do the arguments say? What are the facts here? What is my goal? Who is my audience? All of those sort of metacognitive things are going to become even more important than I think they were a year and a half ago.
And I'm curious, because a lot of the things we're talking about are kind of ChatGPT things that you got to think about. So if you're using one of those publicly, like you can use the free version or you're paying $20 a month. there was a time where like every law school was using Westlaw for legal research, and that kind of dominated. And then, you know, the Florida Bar provides Fastcase. We pay for it, but we provide Fastcase legal research for our members. And now it is VLEX, which also has a really good legal AI, Vincent. But I'm curious, because you are in touch with so many other law professors, what are the products that the students are being exposed to? What are you seeing?
Well, you know, I really can talk about what we have at Stetson. It's going to vary from school to school. Certainly, Lexis and Westlaw both are in the process, if they haven't already, releasing to students generative AI tools through their platforms. So, you know, Lexis has already done that. Westlaw, I believe, will roll out their generative AI tools in January. Some schools will have additional legal databases that they have arrangements with those companies for. Some will have contract drafting software. In some cases, if a student's taking a special course, the student may be buying a subscription to a generative AI tool that is designed for that course. I can think of things like, you know, contract drafting in particular, that is starting to emerge in places. Some universities have their own in-house university, what they might call a sandbox, where faculty, students, and staff can safely experiment, and law schools might have access to that as well. So Microsoft tends to serve a lot of the universities, and as part of the university licenses, Microsoft has rolled out access to Copilot, an enterprise data protected version that students might have access to at any university. And so while that's not a law specific one, it is one that's designed for the business environment. So that, and it has, you know, features that are similar to ChatGPT, for example, not the same, but similar. So, you know, students are getting more and more tools available to them, and many of these tools have training built around them as well. So, you know, there's a lot, I think, happening in this space pretty quickly.
And it's interesting because in the old law firm model, the partners, the paralegals were teaching the newly admitted attorneys how to practice law, how to do all these things. So it's going to be interesting when the students that are coming out of law school now bring this wealth of knowledge for AI to the law firm. And I think that could be a real, you know, boon to their career.
That could very well be. Although I do think, right, that the partners and the senior associates really have a big role to play here in modeling what it means to be a careful legal thinker. Because mm-hmm. one of the dangers of generative AI, I mean, and this is talked about in all sorts of environments, is the idea of over-reliance, right? And novices, mm-hmm. I think, might have a tendency to over-rely more because of a lack of confidence or our general tendency to engage in automation bias, meaning we, you know, we sort of look at the machine, it generates something, and we say to ourselves, well, that must be right.
And it looks so official.
Yeah, right. That looks official. And people teaching legal research, information specialists in law schools, you know, understand this problem of information literacy and digital literacy has been going on for quite a while, and they're addressing those concerns. And AI literacy is really an extension of that. And so, you know, partners and senior associates and others who are supervisors in law firms, they have a duty to ensure that their new associates are using these tools in an ethical way. And that really involves having some wisdom and sharing that wisdom while learning about what the generative AI tool can do in the firm to assist that work. And so, I certainly don't want partners and more experienced lawyers to sort of check out from this. And instead, you know, they should be learning and experimenting as well, and then sharing what they see as the usefulness of the tool with those junior lawyers who may not have that kind of context in order to understand, you know, the bigger picture of this. And we're certainly working on that, but it is a challenge that's been being presented to us as well about how to best teach those things in tandem.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. So collaboration, but a responsibility of tech competence on both sides there.
Absolutely. Yes. And, you know, and thinking about policies as well. Again, going back to Malik, who talks a little bit about this in his book, you know, the experimentation and innovation is going to probably take place on an individual level, which means others in your firm may be thinking about, how can I do this better? How can I do this faster? How could generative AI help me with my legal communication? You may not know it as the manager or the supervisor that this is going on. And so you want to be able to access that innovation because it might really be great for your office and for client services. But on the other hand, it can present some real risks, as we've talked about. And so having policies, having some transparency, helping people understand when it's appropriate to use it and not to use it is really important for, you know, mitigating those risks and capturing that innovation at the same time. You want to make, I think, your employees feel safe about the ways in which they might like to use the tool or might be experimenting with it already, and providing them a space that is ethically appropriate is going to be really important.
I agree. And I wanted to talk more about your paper because you wrote, just interesting questions around authorship, you know, such as reconsidering the definitions of plagiarism now that generative AI has arrived. So can you elaborate more on that point?
Yes. So, you know, one of the challenges in law school is academic integrity with this tool, right? So the goal of any writing assignment in a law school context is not only to learn the skills of practice, but it is also for us to be able to assess what the student has learned. And if a generative AI tool can approximate that learning, and that can be done without student engagement, and that's very hard to tell, right? So I might get lucky, we'll call it lucky, and a generative AI tool could generate all of that content on its own, then I might not be able to assess very well what the student has actually learned. So we're rethinking the questions of academic integrity and what assessment should look like and what it means to have AI inclusive and AI resistant assignments and how we might use those and what kinds of ways we might get at those. With respect to plagiarism in particular, the question really becomes, you know, this idea of borrowing and what is appropriate for borrowing. So, you know, lawyers tend to borrow language from other documents pretty readily and use that to assist clients. And, you know, in the practice of law, we like to think of, you know, borrowing from authority as really important. And we want you to do that. And we want you to quote and paraphrase authority. And so we don't really consider that plagiarism. We consider that to be not such a, you know, a really good idea. And you want to put your citations in there and you want to show that this content is borrowed. But with generative AI, you know, the question is there something inauthentic either in the law school context or in the practice context about borrowing language that has been generated wholly by an AI tool? So imagine you ask generative AI to generate for you an introduction to a brief, and it does a really good job, and maybe you change one word and you want to borrow that text on the whole. In the law school context, you know, our question is that plagiarism for the purposes of academic integrity, right? Do we need to see more work that the student does with that or not borrow at all? But in the practice context, you know, is there something about AI-gerism, right, or plagiarism in that regard that makes that text inauthentic to you as the writer? I mean, that's kind of the plagiarism idea, although it's not directly the same. And my sense at this point is that, you know, you would not need a citation for that kind of borrowed language because you're not citing to authority. Let's say if there were places where you needed to cite to authority, you would do that. But the fact that generative AI generated a sentence for you, you know, that's not authority. And you, as the provider of the information, as a lawyer, are taking ethical responsibility for it. So, you know, what I'm really doing here is exploring that concept with you. In other words, I'm not sure that I have a fixed answer to that yet, but that's where plagiarism may need to be reconsidered, is what does it mean to borrow language from a generative AI tool? Must we cite it? Must we disclose it? And you can see courts all dealing with this problem, too, and the kinds of standing orders that they have with respect to disclosure requirements.
Oh, it did. I also, did you coin a new term? Because I have not heard AI-igerism.
Yeah.
Plagiarism, AI-igerism.
Yes, I like that.
I wish I could say that it's mine. I'm sure I've read that somewhere. But, you know, when we're thinking about it in law school, you really do have two buckets. Plagiarism, you know, is borrowing language from a source that I can find. And we do have, you know, plagiarism detectors in the higher education environment that allow us to take a paper and find other language. AI-gerism, right, is a different question. I can't search for that content in the same way because, you know, that is generated from scratch each time a person touches the tool. And there is no way to find a database of that information, right? And so, you know, the questions of AI use bring up different questions of authorship and ownership and ethics that are not the same as plagiarism directly. And so I am uncomfortable when we put it in the same bucket because I think it raises different questions.
Yeah, and that makes total sense. But it's got to be a real challenge because, like you said before, students could be required to upload their assignment paper to the software that would check it for you. So they would like get a green check or whatever before it got submitted. But if you, and we've done this in real time, like with the committee, and I've tried it too, where you put the exact same prompt into three different large language models and you get very different results and you can like, you know, some of this one, take some of that one. And so, yeah, where did it, I don't know. When did the authorship start?
That's absolutely right. And so, you know, for myself, I mean, I'm finding that I use generative AI tools almost on a daily basis for the kinds of things that I've been explaining to you. Brainstorming, restructuring text, generating pieces of text, summarizing things that I've read, taking content that might be in a bullet point form and helping me express it in paragraphs. I mean, there are thinking about tone, even doing some investigation into things because now a number of generative AI tools are integrated with search tools that allow us to check our work, right? To at least go and see if the citation that it's providing will provide support. And so I'm using it on a daily basis for my work. And it is not consistent, right? I mean, I can't put in the same prompt 10 times and get the same results. And for lawyers, that lack of precision is a danger. And the lack of auditing is a danger. Now, that's changing as well, right? There's a little more tools that allow you to internally audit what's there and have that kind of information. But, you know, even AI scientists don't know exactly how generative AI works to generate its responses. And so we need to be concerned about that. But where it becomes a concern is if we don't think carefully about how we're using the tool. And again, I come back to this each time. That is really the key for lawyers, is engaged use as a collaborator or an assistant.
All right. So we always like to have give some practical like action items for our listeners. So if set aside your professor hat for a moment, if you were starting a small law firm and you're the managing partner, what would be your best practices for managing the relationship between attorneys and AI at each stage of the legal research or writing process? Like, what would be just a couple policies that you would distribute to the members of your team at your firm?
Well, I certainly would be clear on what information can be shared and can't be shared and with which tools. I would want all of my lawyers to have training because your knowledge of your knowledge or artificial intelligence literacy is what's going to allow you to be thoughtful, successful users of the tool. I would, as you have mentioned, I would think very carefully about what I want to let clients know upfront about AI use and the use of their information. I would after, you know, these kinds of trainings and these policies in place, I would encourage regular communication with my junior lawyers, if I have them, or my paralegals or other office staff about how we're using it, where we're finding it useful in the process. Those would be, I think, my thoughts about it. I think, you know, when we originally got these tools, there was sort of this notion that this was going to be a lawyer replacement and that we might have the option to just, you know, sort of check out. I am finding that there are so many interesting things this tool can do and wonderful ways to use it successfully, but it requires us to check in a lot more than checking out. And so that would be my mantra is, you know, stay engaged, stay checked in, have a framework in place that minimizes the risks for you, but then that creates real spaces for innovation that benefits clients.
And, you know, for attorneys that might be hesitant to use AI, what are some of the biggest misconceptions about AI that, you know, you would tell someone if yeah. they're not sure?
One of the big misconceptions is that you can and will replace you as a lawyer. I don't think that that's true. I think it will change the nature of the duties that you have, not the duties, the tasks that you might perform. But I don't think we should be afraid of it because we think it's going to replace what we do. I think they worry that they will lose their humanness as an author. And I think, you know, again, understanding how to best use the tool guards against that. I think there's a big fear of hallucination, and we certainly can guard against that. But again, you know, I don't think any lawyer should use something that they're not comfortable with. And right, that would go against your duty of being ethically competent with the technology, right? And so the real goal here is to learn, train, read, experiment safely to figure out where, you know, in your writing process, and every process is unique, that this fits best for you.
Very good.
All good things to think about. And then you talked about that this is a little bit earlier, that it, because of the time savings, that this could be an access to justice, real boost. Because if you can reduce the cost of providing those legal services, that's, you know, more people are going to be able to afford attorneys. But can you talk about how you see the future of legal research and writing evolving now that AI is there? Like, do you think attorneys will need to develop more maybe person-to-person skills because they're going to spend more human time with their clients because they're not spending so much time? You know, what part of this is going to free them up? What is it going to look like if they're fully using this in the best way?
I think it very much can let you think more deeply about the questions that confront your clients, and it could very well allow for more client care. You know, I just think about, I'll just give you an example. I had read an article about generative AI and a study out of the University of Minnesota about students drafting four different kinds of documents with and without AI, and how the quality and efficiency improved or didn't improve in that study, right? And I read that article carefully and I knew what it said, but I wanted to present those results to an audience that may not regularly read scientific study results. And I wanted to present it as a table. I wanted it to gather all that, the machine to gather information from that document, and then present it kind of in a narrative way. I explain, you know, present this in a way that someone who doesn't normally read these kind of charts would be able to read across the chart in an easier way. And of course, it did that really quickly. And I thought it had made a mistake because as I'm checking all the work, which I absolutely have to do to make sure it's right, I go back and I check and I think it's misunderstood something. It turns out Kirsten misunderstood something and that it had actually gotten the content correct. But what it did even better was think of a really interesting way to present that information and kind of a using language as you read across each row to explain what's going on in that particular row. And that was really creative and really inventive, I thought. And it was super helpful to me. And the time I would have spent doing that would have been a couple hours. Right. So searching through the document, coming up with these ways of describing the content. But it did that for me very quickly. I was able to check its work. I felt confident that it was accurate. I could have asked it to try other variations and it would have done that pretty quickly. And I thought, okay, now I have extra time, right? What can I do with that extra time? And I'm thinking about, could that serve? I'm not serving clients in the same way. I'm serving students, but how could I improve my client service, my student service? How could I take time for some self-care here that makes me more accessible and available to those who need me? How could I take on a project that, you know, has been needing attention and I can't get to? So those are the kinds of things that I think, you know, in terms of the drafting and writing process, we'll find that, you know, services, not only the quality of the services improved, but the ability to do more in other ways can be improved. So I don't know what all those things will be, but I do think that that is the potential future here, is that the tool becomes integrated in a way that allows improvement all the way around in the services provided.
I love that example because you're saying it could enhance your personal and your professional life. So, I mean, and I see that being carried out to, you know, maybe improving mental health and wellness of attorneys if they have some time back.
I think that's right. And again, I think there are real access to justice possibilities with, you know, being able to leverage generative AI again in a responsible and ethical and thoughtful way. You know, I think less about sort of an automated way, but definitely, you know, it as an assistant to legal providers who already have that lawyer intelligence.
Well, it looks like we've reached the end of our program. Thank you so much, Professor Kirsten Davis, for joining us today.
You are most welcome. Thanks for having me.
If you like what you heard today, please rate us in Apple Podcasts and join us next time for another episode of the Florida Bar's Legal Fuel Podcast, brought to you by the Practice Resource Center of the Florida Bar. I'm Christine Bilbrey.
And I'm Jamie Moore. Until next time, thank you for listening.
If you'd like more information about today's show, please visit legalfuel.com. Don't miss an episode by subscribing to the Florida Bar's podcast via iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and RSS. Find the Florida Bar's Practice Resource Center, Legal Fuel, on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by, the Florida Bar. None of the content should be considered legal advice. As always, consult a lawyer.